and welcome to Through the Pinard, your conversational podcast talking to midwives around the world about the research they are doing to improve midwifery practice. This research can range from small quality improvement programs and projects to those starting partway through or just finishing their postgraduate studies, and to those that have been there, done that, and got the t-shirt. So settle back and enjoy the conversation. And remember, you can continue the conversation on Twitter after you finish listening. Thank you very much for joining me tonight, as per usual. Can you introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, sure. I'm Dr. Maeve Ann O'Connell, and I am Assistant Professor of Midwifery at Fatima College in Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates. I'm Irish, and I am a midwife. I graduated in 2008 as a midwife, and I am also a registered nurse. I graduated in 2004 from nursing. So I have many years of experience in both nursing and midwifery, and I have a master's from King's College London, and I have a PhD from University College Cork. I guess this podcast is about my PhD. So
it's about everything, really. It's been interesting that it is about the PhD, but also people have been fascinated about hearing people's journey into midwifery, hearing people's journey through midwifery, and then the journeys into kind of postgrad and into research and then whatever. So it all kind of like fits. So then I'm going to go back and go, so you started nursing. What got you into the purple side of midwifery?
Oh, we love it. Okay. So, yeah, I started my nursing directly out of school. And back then, I was not interested in midwifery. I was not interested in babies, nothing like that. I worked actually in male medical, which is the complete opposite, as a staff nurse for 2 years. And I absolutely loved it. But I think that's the story of my life, is I love wherever I work. Like, I'm just one of those people who walks into a ward, an area, a team, and I'm always very like positive and optimistic, and I'll always see the best side of things, even if it's really difficult. I'll always like, you know, put my best foot forward. So I worked in South Infirmary in Cork, and I rotated around all the areas. Now, one of the areas there was gynae, and I did focus there on gynae quite a bit, and we would have had many different cases there. And I guess a lot of my colleagues would have gone on to do midwifery, because postgraduate midwifery is sort of something that is like not unusual to do. When I finished my BSc in midwifery, I had to make up time actually, and I had to go back and do a little placement in maternity. And being a little bit older at 21 then, rather than 18 when I did my first maternity placement, I realised it was more to making beds, which was what I was doing in the first maternity placement. Yep. And when I went back this time, I actually saw a couple of births. And once I witnessed that first birth, I was hooked. Yep. And I remember actually the ward sister saying, oh my God, she's got it, because I didn't want to leave until I saw that birth actually happen. So I was on a half day on the shift, and I didn't leave until 4 o'clock. Until the woman had actually given birth. So I was just hooked on it, like that emotion and the whole magic really of birth. Mm. So once I saw birth, I was definitely hooked, and I knew that I would want to go back and do it at some time. So after 2 years of being a nurse, I went back to do my postgraduate diploma in midwifery in the same place in University College Cork. We had a lovely class. There was about 20 of us in the class, and we were very close, and it was a really nice experience doing my postgraduate diploma in midwifery, and so that was good. Once I graduated, I didn't work in Cork though. I was the only one who left, and I went straight to UK to work in London, and I did like a preceptorship band 5 rotation in Chelsea Westminster NHS Foundation Trust. And that was a really nice experience, because I was obsessed with the fact that I'd kind of had obstetric training more than midwifery, because that was my perception of it at the time. I guess I knew that there was more out there, that, you know, midwives working in their full scope of practice. And I really wanted to find out more about that. So I always felt a little bit on the back foot going to the UK and being newly qualified and being Irish and coming from more medicalized environments. You know, where I trained, there was a curtain between two women giving birth, and they were mostly in a anatomy position. There wasn't room in the room to actually get them up off the bed and mobilize or anything like that. And you know, it was mostly CTGs, and it was mostly sort of on their back and pushing things like that. But then we moved to a different unit, a more modern unit, and there was all sorts of changes happened. And that was in 2006, I think they moved, or 2007. I was part of that move into the new unit, Cork University Maternity Hospital. And it was so exciting. It was so exciting at that time, 2007, when everybody moved into the CUMH. And basically, we amalgamated three units. So there was the Erneville, which is kind of where I was training. Then there was St. Finbarr's Hospital and the Bonds. The Bonds was the private. So you had all these midwives coming together to work, who had all worked in their own different ways. And suddenly we all had to work together. Wow. And we're in a new building. And it was a very exciting time to actually be a midwife. So it's open now. How many years, did I say? Is it 15 years now?
2006, yeah.
Yeah, for 15 years. And there's great things happening there. There's a lovely domino team there. There's a pregnancy loss team there. And there's a research team there that I actually did come back to do my PhD with. So I did come back to CUMH in 2013. Anyway, I worked in Chelsea Westminster. Then I worked in St. Thomas's. And in St. Thomas's, I did normal postnatal. I was labour ward for ages. I was on the hospital birth centre there working as labour ward midwife. Then I went on to specialise, and I was in the high risk team working with a caseloading team who worked with women with medical conditions. So anyone with diabetes, cardiac conditions, feeding disorders, Crohn's disease, basically anything with a medical condition, which was so, so interesting in that particular part of the world. In Lambeth and Southwark in London, which is an impoverished area. And so we saw many different comorbidities, and we worked with women to really optimize their physiology and give them that continuity of care and that relationship and that trusting relationship, and working with them to give them the birth that they wanted, and also the postnatal support in the community. We would go out into the community and visit them as well, which was really, really lovely. And it was just lovely to be part of a team.
That's the growing area of research, I think, that's starting to come out now, as we know continuity of care is fabulous. But the benefits that it has with high-risk women is that because of their fractionated kind of care, because they're visiting so many different specialists, like, it's almost that they need it more to actually have that continuity.
Absolutely. And I think with the Embrace report, it's coming out more and more, you know, the importance of having that link person. And my role there was really sort of really knowing the patient inside and out. And I would really sort of link them in. So let's just say it was a woman, because of course people are really complex. They don't just come with one thing. You could have a mental health issue and also have diabetes, and also have, you know, maybe sickle cell, something else going on. So you can get really some complex women. And then linking together all of that care, you might have a social worker, obstetric medicine, you might have fetal medicine involved, you know, there might be a fetal anomaly diagnosed. There's all sorts of things that can be going on. And linking all of that together, and then you're the person who's actually kind of directly communicating all the time with the woman, having that relationship. You've got your mobile, you're on call, you know, responding to the results, communicating their blood results, things like that. And it was just so rewarding. I absolutely loved working in that job. And that is kind of what led me to my PhD. So I did my master's while I was on the high-risk team. I was supported by my matron and the team there at St. Thomas's to do my master's, which I did it actually on smoking cessation in pregnancy. And I looked at midwives' experience of using the carbon monoxide breath test for smoking cessation. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed the actual research process and just being involved. I was really like driven and really self-motivated at the time, just really interested in being part of this this research and having these findings, which I thought were just like, I just found it so sort of, I don't know, I was just fell in love with the research really at that time.
So what were the, was that qualitative or quantitative? And what were the findings?
It was qualitative. So it was a phenomenological piece of research which looked at midwives' experience of using carbon monoxide breath tests for smoking cessation. So basically, they introduced this breath test, which gives you a reading when you breathe into it. You get a reading for the mother and a reading for the fetus. And it depended, so NICE guidelines recommended it at that time. And it depended on whether it was opt-in or opt-out referral system. Maybe every woman would get the breath test, or in some places it was only if you were a smoker. But there was a lot of controversy at the time, and Daily Mail, places like that, were reporting, oh my God, this is like policing of women. Women have the right to smoke during pregnancy. It was actually quite controversial. It was in the media. And so I decided to see, well, what's happening on the ground? Like, what's midwives' experience? And actually what they found was that, like any screening thing, women, if they had the information beforehand, they were fine.
Yep.
But if they didn't know what to expect, and it was upsetting. Some women cried, some women felt guilty when they saw the fetal reading. They were like, well, I'm highly addicted. Like, they feel really guilty for you know, having this impact on the fetus. What can I do? And some places didn't have the referral systems in place. So if you do detect that someone, you know, has a carbon monoxide reading, then what are you going to do with that information? Are you going to refer them to smoking cessation? Is it mandatory? Do they have the option? Is it opt-in, opt-out? And then midwives were saying it was like another thing to do in the clinic, so like time constraints. But what they were actually doing in practice was delegating it to a HCA or a midwife support worker, and they would get them to actually document the figure, and then they can have the discussing and the counselling with the midwife in the appointment to save time. But I, overall, it was actually well accepted, because actually women do want to sort of do whatever is seen as best for their baby and best for their pregnancy. And so like any screening in general, it was mostly accepted. So it was interesting. And I think meeting those midwives as well and having the opportunity, because when you're working as a midwife in your own area, you don't really meet other midwives from other places.
True.
And I was going into a hospital in North London and seeing more to life. You know, it was like this exposure to a whole other team, a different kind of cohort of women. And, oh, this is how these midwives work, and this is what they do. And actually, I don't know, it's just kind of opens up your world, doesn't it, a little bit?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's the magical things, even chatting with colleagues yesterday and looking at how they do certain things in their units, and they're kind of from another state. But it is that kind of like that, finding the different rationales. But also, if you're going to implement something like that is a screening tool, you need to have those procedures set in of what you're going to do with whatever the result comes back. Because if you don't have those, that follow through and that referral, as you mentioned, it's pointless. It's a wasted service to offer, because you are going to potentially distress women and not have anywhere to actually lead them.
So I met some wonderful smoking cessation midwives as well, some really passionate leaders in the field, which wasn't my field at the time or anything. And these women really were like so passionate about what they were doing. They were like, we need a referral system. We can't just implement this. And that's why I felt like my findings were so important, because I was giving them a voice and was putting it down in literature, and also publishing. So I think that's a really important part of this as well, is like, okay, I did my master's, but I actually published the findings, which was really important. And I got the opportunity as well to present the findings at the King's College conference as well, which was really, really nice. And it just gave me that kind of confidence to be like, okay, a bit of acknowledgement as well for the work that I'd done. So it was kind of my first taste of research. And then after that, I was at a point where I was like, well, what do I want to do and where do I want to go? And basically a chance meeting
that happened so many times
helped me decide what to do. So yeah, I was back in Cork on my holidays, and I had made a few phone calls. It wasn't just a chance meeting. I had made a few phone calls because I was interested in pursuing more research, but I didn't know at what level I wanted to do with that. Did I just like want to get a research job or what? What did I want to do? And my master's supervisor was Dr. Maria Dweso in King's College, and she was really supportive. And she was kind of, I had had a few phone calls with her, and she said to ring University College Cork, where I was from, to see what were the options there. So I'd had a few calls with people there. And it wasn't very clear, the whole application process for a PhD, to me. It looked very overwhelming. It was like, oh my gosh, I don't, this is something for me. Like, I'm only a midwife. I don't know, like, this is for someone up here, you know?
Yep.
And so I was thinking more along the lines of a research job. So I was home in the summer, and I was at an appointment with my sister in the Cork University Hospital. And sitting in the waiting room, I happened to bump into a consultant obstetrician who recognized me. And he was like, Maeve, what are you doing these days? I said, oh, I'm actually just home from London. I'm on my holidays. I just finished my master's. And he was like, oh yeah, would you ever consider working back here? I said, yeah, I would actually. I said, I'm kind of in a, you know, wondering what I'm going to do. He said, guess what? We're opening this infant research center. I said, oh, tell me more. So it was kind of timing. And yeah, basically I submitted my CV and got a job as a research midwife. And I asked them, could I do a PhD? And they said, yes.
Fabulous.
Which is very unusual. And I know
it's the stories that I've heard so far, both the ones that I've recorded and the ones that I haven't, and just conversations, the serendipity of the right timing, the right conversation, the right meeting, just grabbing an opportunity because you're not quite sure. And as a couple of people said, jump and the net will appear. That if you take that kind of, that next adventure, you never know where it's going to end up. And a lot of people have ended up in places that they never thought they would have been, but they just love it. And that's kind of now guided the rest of their career, which is kind of like quite cool. So what were you doing in research before you started your PhD, or did you go into your PhD fairly soon?
So basically, I was contracted as a research midwife at the Infant Research Centre. And there was a cohort study for preeclampsia called the IMPROVE study, which I was part of a team. There was about three midwives were employed on that research study. And we were basically recruiting participants and getting their consent, organising their ultrasound, and then we'd do appointments with them at 12 weeks, 20 weeks and 30 weeks, something like that, to take bloods for biometrics, or what are they called? For the biobank, blood for the biobank anyway. And we would just take all of their information, demographics, things like that. So it was really enjoyable. It was lovely. It was like actually like continuity, because you'd meet the women throughout their pregnancy and they really enjoyed being part of it. And we would give them some sort of midwifery advice and things like that.
Yeah.
So it was lovely, really nice job. But so I started that job in September 2013. And at the same time, so when I started, I had proposed doing the PhD for some reason. And so it was with the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology rather than School of Nursing and Midwifery, and an obstetrician, Professor Louise Kenny, was supporting me to do that. So Louise was like, hey, Maeve, you've got this opportunity. What are you going to do PhD on? And I was like, okay, I can come up with all these ideas. I did think about going on with smoking cessation. I did toy with that for a little while. And then I took some time to do some reading, and there was some, she had some access to some databases for me, and I had toyed with the idea of doing some sort of epidemiological studies for a while. And then I was like, basically I had an idea, and I was like, I don't know this, if this is out there or how you feel about this, but let me just put this out there.
Yep.
And basically I said, look, during my job, my last job, I actually caseloaded some women with fear of childbirth.
Mm-hmm.
And So we were getting these referrals to the high-risk medical team for women with fear of childbirth. So they didn't actually have a medical condition.
Yep.
But we didn't have anywhere to put them. And I wound up taking them. And so other midwives did as well. But it was just really interesting to me. I was like, what's this about? Like, is this a new thing? Have you gotten here in Ireland? Have you heard of it? Like, let's find out some more about this. So Louise came back to me and she said, look, I agree with you. Like, we both have seen this in practice, but it's not something that, like, there's any facilities for. We don't have any specific counselling. There's nothing known about this. So I think this is a really great idea. So then I was like, great. Now what?
Oops. Now I have to do it.
Yeah. Now what? So I was like, okay. And then I remember she was like, right. So this was like October. And she was like, right, you're going to publish something for Christmas. When you come back from Christmas, you're going to have a deadline and you're going to write your first paper. I was like, oh, okay. Well, I had to do like a literature review over the Christmas period. And anyway, I read so many things. And looking back now, like, that was actually such a good foundation for all of my PhD, because I actually know that literature inside and out. Yep. Now, you know, all of those papers. And actually, there wasn't a lot of literature back then, like back in 2013, 2014, there was honestly, like, I'd say less than 100 papers on fear of childbirth and tachyphobia. I could name all of the authors. I could name all of the teams. They're all Swedish, yep, Norwegian, Finnish.
Oh, and really? That's interesting. So Scandinavians were way ahead. So
they were. And then I also met Jocelyn Tuhill from Australia.
Yep.
And she was so lovely as well and very supportive. And so then she published around that time her randomized control trial, which I think it was 2014. So there was that team as well, Jenny Fennick and Jenny Gamble and Jocelyn Tuhill. I've actually had so many supportive experiences during my PhD, especially from midwives. Jocelyn Tuhill actually came to visit us in the infant center as well. During my PhD, and she presented on her work, which was like just brilliant. So I was part-time doing my PhD for the first 2 years, and then I went full-time in 2016 or 2017, I can't remember, I think it's 2017 I went full-time. And once I went full time, really, I just didn't look back. I really enjoyed. That was when I started to enjoy my research and actually kind of really get absorbed in it and really sort of live it. I think until you really are living it, you're not going to finish it. It is hard. I found myself anyway. I can't multitask very well. I need to focus on something to get something done. And once I decide to focus on something and get it done, I really will try my best to do that. But if I don't have the headspace, then it's very challenging for me personally. I know people can. But for me, I just needed to have that total immersion in everything. So I did some research on fear of childbirth. I did a systematic review and meta-analysis of the prevalence of fear of childbirth. Then we did a cross-sectional study of the prevalence of fear of childbirth in Ireland. And then we looked at the outcomes for some of those women who were in the cross-sectional study. And then I did a meta-synthesis of the interventions for fear of childbirth, women's experiences of interventions for fear of childbirth. I should say that when I went full-time, I gave up work, so I was self-funding at that point.
Yep.
Now, I always worked as a midwife. I always did agency, nursing and midwifery. I worked in the emergency room. I worked in antenatal ward, neonatal unit, wherever they'd put me, I'd work. So I always had that sort of to fund me. But I was fortunate enough to apply for, and I was supported to apply for by my advisory team for a Cochrane Fellowship.
Oh, nice. HRB
Cochrane Fellowship.
Congratulations. That's cool.
I got a scholarship from the HRB to do a Cochrane review called Interventions for Fear of Childbirth. But actually, the original title was something else, and then it changed. So basically, it took a lot longer because of sort of jigs and reels of changing titles and things like that. That was published only last year. But I got there in the end, and it was actually very, very tough to get there in the end through through everything, because you're going to hear my story that I've been in a lot of countries and a lot of places in the last 5 years. My PhD has taken me so many different places. So I did all of those pieces of research, a lot of different pieces of research on fear of childbirth. And it was just so, so interesting. I also got a cost program bursary to travel to Sweden to the team there at in Uppsala. I visited Professor Ingehard Hildingsson and Christine Rubertson and Birgitta Larsson, Annika Karlstrom, a midwifery team there, and that was just amazing, especially having read all of their literature, and suddenly you put a face to a name and you're sort of out having lunch and somebody says, oh hi, I'm Annika, and I'm like, oh, Karlstrom.
fangirl moment. Yeah,
you know all the surnames, and it's like, oh yeah, now I know who you are, why didn't you say your surname all along? This is like really weird midwifery academia, like,
oh, you know, they're prolific up there. They're really prolific with the work that they put out.
And they're so supportive as well. They're a really lovely team of midwives, you know, and I'm still in contact with those midwives. It's just been so, so interesting, I suppose, to follow this team of fear of childbirth research and to see sort of where it's going, because it's been very prolific and suddenly it's kind of expanding on a global level. And I guess I have some concerns about the framing of fear of childbirth and where are we going with this?
Oh, yeah.
And so that's why I've kind of slowed up a little bit on it, because if you've read my more recent papers, I've a paper called Reconsidering Fear of Childbirth with Julie Jameen and Colin Martin, where we talk about we say, OK, hold up, wait a minute. This is quite new research. What exactly are we talking about? What is this concept? And what are we doing to sort of improve care for women? Because at the end of the day, that's why we're researching.
Absolutely.
I guess when you focus a lot on quantitative research and you're measuring fear of childbirth or measuring anxiety, and the concepts are not very clearly well defined, how are we going to make this useful? How are we going to actually help women? So I'm really trying to sort of change my mindset around this whole thing. And part of the findings of the Cochrane Review were that actually, these interventions do reduce fear of childbirth, but not in a clinically meaningful way. So if we look at the measurements, it might not necessarily be clinically meaningful. And also the concept of fear of childbirth is overlapping with anxiety, and yet these trials never measured anxiety. And another concept which they haven't measured is birth satisfaction, which for me, that's really important. If you're doing an intervention for fear of childbirth, well, how was the birth for that woman? Like, what happened? Was she satisfied? How was she after the birth? So we need a lot more qualitative research in the area. I definitely think we need to look at birth satisfaction. And really, we just need to sort of we need to look at a more woman-centered approach. We need to really get women involved in the research as well. We need to bring in PPI, getting women involved. And I was part of a really excellent tocophobia expert consensus panel led by Julie Jameen, funded by the SRIP. Which is a fantastic society. If you are a PhD student in the area of perinatal mental health, they have got some bursaries available for things like workshops where you want to bring experts together and things like that. So that's a useful resource for any PhD students out there in perinatal mental health. So the SRIP sponsored us to meet together, and we did publish an expert consensus statement as well on tocophobia. And the consensus was really that there is no consensus at the moment, and there's still a lot of research to be done. I think really trying to have a woman-centered approach and empowering women and giving them a voice, and I think what's happened traditionally in the literature is that it's been very sort of focused on the mode of birth.
Yep.
You know, the relationship between fear of childbirth and the desire to have a cesarean section to reduce the cesarean section. Well, actually, you know, we want a woman who's emotionally intact. And actually, if they want to have a cesarean section, part of that, that's part of their individualized care. And I think we're really working towards individualized, personalized care.
Yep.
It's one of the outcomes of all the recent reports. Of note, we know that we need to look at individual circumstances and stop looking at the sort of how to describe it. You know what I'm trying to say, Liz?
Yeah.
I top this bit out.
Yeah. but it's also kind of like looking. It is that factor that we get so caught up. Instead of going what women-centered care is, but it's women-centered care to what suits for us, not actually what suits for them, and understanding that they are all individual and they all have their different reasons for it. And yes, ideally we want to decrease the cesarean section rate, but it's also alongside that kind of discussion is the contentious discussion on breastfeeding and formula feeding and expressing that it's the choice. It's the choice of what a woman wants and for her own reasons, but it all comes down to informed consent. Ultimately, everything comes down to if we give them the information on all the options, pros and cons, they then make an informed consent, which we then kind of like work with them to uphold.
And then what I did find during my PhD was, so I had so many women come forward. My PhD got a lot of attention in the media. Women were aware of the research. It was picked up in the national news. And women were coming forward to me and they were saying, I'm 40, I've been married 12 years and I've been to the UK for an abortion because I'm so terrified of giving birth. I don't want to give birth in the current services that we have. I don't feel like I have a choice. They were saying things like, some women were saying like they were afraid of intervention and they wanted to have a low risk managed by a midwife sort of birth, and they were really terrified of having a cesarean section. I met a woman at a conference in Dublin who told me that her local area had a 48% cesarean section rate. She was para 2 and she was well informed. She said, I am terrified to go in for this baby because I really just want to have a normal birth to get out and look after my toddlers.
So do you think that the reasons for tocophobia in Ireland are different because of the setup and because of the kind of the religious rulings, as opposed to other countries, and that what their common reasons are for this increasing fear? Or do you think overall it's actually very similar?
I think that overall it's very similar, and I don't think that we give women credit. I don't really like this whole narrative of, silly women sort of watching social media and getting fear, because I don't like that narrative. I think women are well informed. I think we shouldn't infantilize them. Yep. They make their decisions and actually they're well capable to make their decisions. I think that, yes, there are definitely cultural components to fear of childbirth. And all over the world, we have now evidence from low to middle income countries, as well as, lots of different countries. Now we have information on fear of childbirth, and actually they have similar sorts of fears. And you know, it is associated with things like low social support, low informational support. It's associated with depression. Women with fear of childbirth are far more likely to have depression in the postnatal period. So it's really, really important that we are open to the conversation and that we're asking them early in their pregnancy about any fears that they might have, because we can myth bust. And we can break down any of these sort of ideas that they might have and say, well, actually, look, if you only want to have a female midwife or carer in labour, we can accommodate that. OK, maybe, maybe it can be a simple thing like saying, OK, actually, you haven't got a private room. There's, you know, it's not going, you're not going to be on a multiple ward with 6 women in labour. Yep. You're going to be in a room on your own once you're in active labour. And we would aim to have one-to-one care in labour, because a lot of women dread being left alone in labour.
Yeah, yeah.
I think during COVID that was very difficult for women because they did have to face that. And that is really, really challenging. Imagine being told that you have to be on your own and not allowed to have your partner. I mean, that's just really, really bad. And not having the option of having continuity of midwifery
care. We're going to be dealing with the consequences of those solo births for many years, I think, because of not having there, because of, and the decisions were made, and there's going to be a lot of investigations into what decisions were made where with the knowledge that was known at the time. But yeah, that's going to, I think, be potentially generational. There's a whole cohort of women who gave birth over the last kind of like 2 years. And even now, thankfully, most places have got one support person can go in. So you don't have that kind of pure isolation. And I'm so really surprised that with all this world, we found out that Zoom worked really well, and wish I had shares in Zoom before the coronavirus came out. But why have we not been using technology with the separation? So when women have been forced to go into appointments by themselves because of COVID, when women have been forced to give birth for themselves, why have we not been using technology to bring that support kind of like into the room, so at least they've got somebody else to talk to? Because I don't think that's happened as much as what it could have.
I agree. It's very sad. And like, I think this pandemic has had an impact on everybody's lives, but particularly the lives of first-time mothers, especially. I think if you've had your first baby in the pandemic, it's very, very challenging. And we've had women have two babies or even maybe now three babies in the pandemic at this stage, and who are coming out the other side of it now. But definitely, you know, they had to cope with an awful lot of stress and anxiety and everything.
And we know the importance of antenatal education and the antenatal kind of giving of information and ability to ask questions. And then we've got this kind of group of women who didn't have that as much of opportunity as that, because they didn't have the antenatal visits. And there's so much magic that happens in those antenatal visits.
But yet fear of childbirth didn't go up during the pandemic.
Interesting.
Yes, and I'm wondering if part of it is that they had more time to read up at home, and that they had more self-belief in their own bodies, and they were more relaxed, and women had flexible working hours. So it didn't change. It didn't fluctuate, the prevalence, like studies that were conducted during the pandemic. There wasn't an increased rate, but it was more or less static, which is sort of, that's kind of
interesting.
It's interesting.
All the other stress that was happening. Wasn't there a decrease in premature babies from COVID? So yeah, maybe they were more relaxed and kind of more in tune with what was happening.
And some of them had more support if they were both working from home. If you had a partner, both of you working from home, possibly you had more support in your city, but maybe not your family coming in and out, because we were in isolation and lockdown. And then there were more, I think, more home births in Ireland potentially at that time, or wish for home births anyway. I don't know. There was more demand on the home birth system. I think that's maybe changed now.
That would be possibly, it'd be interesting to know, that people didn't want to go into the hospitals because of the risk of COVID. So kind of like stayed home longer and kind of either planned births or unplanned births.
Yeah. But wasn't it interesting how during COVID it was like anything seemed possible? Do you have that feeling like where it was like, okay, come on, let's do a Zoom meeting. Okay, come on, let's change policy on this. All of a sudden it was like, well, the world's going to end, so come on, let's do whatever needs to be done. It was like, whatever needs to be done, we'll just break that red tape and get it done as fast as we possibly can. And like, it was amazing, wasn't it? That sense of
that. And I think that was the first technology.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. The rapid reviews that were coming out were just something that, when we think about, and I know there's a lot of kind of the COVID vaccinations, of course, a lot of concern and hesitancy. But when you look at the amount of communication that was happening, the open disclosure that was happening, then that was facilitating all of the sharing of the information and the advances that had already started years ago, especially with SARS and MERS. And so that, and it was interesting watching on Twitter and kind of following through on Twitter and some of the big players. It was like, right, I need a review in 2 weeks. We need this done. Who's got some time to do it? And people were just kind of going in, and therefore that early cohort studies and looking at what was happening was quite fascinating to see come out and still be peer reviewed.
Yeah. Yeah, peer review is something that we're always looking for. I'm an associate editor at Women and Birth. Please peer review for us. I'll throw that in case Caroline Homer is listening.
We don't survive. We don't survive in the system because we all want peer review, but then it's knowing that you need to know your own scope of practice to know what you can say yes and no to actually go, yep, I can actually give a qualified judgment on this, or hell no, don't understand any of those numbers. I'm passing this to somebody else. But then it's also the reading of it. It's really interesting. I quite enjoy it because you get to see what other people are doing beforehand, but then you get to, as you're looking at theirs and making comments on theirs, you're automatically improving your own writing as well.
Yeah.
And so it kind of, it ends up, you do end up giving back to yourself as well as to the profession.
I think it's so important. I didn't do a lot of peer review during my PhD. I waited until sort of towards the end, because I do think your time is really precious during your PhD and you really have to focus on your PhD work, which is very difficult when there's like lots of different things happening and all the attractive other stuff is happening, but you have to finish what you're actually doing. So I did limit, I'd say I did about 4 peer reviews during my PhD. But then in the following years, I did lots of peer reviews, and definitely it's such a worthwhile experience. And you learn so many different things. And again, like you said, casting that net out there, but keeping it within the realms of your actual expertise and experience. Yes, I do work for Women in Birth. And it's a very nice journal if anyone is interested in submitting a paper there for publication or for open for peer review. Please do let us know, and we'd be happy to have you on board as a peer reviewer. I've done many different things. Honestly, this PhD has opened so many doors for me, and like I never thought I would say that I would be like on a committee or working with the likes of Caroline Homer and Hannah Dallin and all of that team in Women in Birth. And it's just so fantastic. They're really supportive. I've written some editorials with them. It's just
You're fantastic. The future. You're part of the future that kind of sustains and takes over from them. So it is that that passing down and that mentoring that kind of goes through. Which leads us to the next part after your PhD. My passport is really full.
So after my PhD, I obviously needed to get work. And so I was like a detective. Maeve, what am I going to do? I really want to travel. I'm open to experiences. What would I like to do? So somebody told me about a girl called Liz Weathers, Dr. Liz Weathers, who was a former PhD student of my supervisor, Patricia Leahy Warren. And I had never met her. And it's one of those things where everyone's like, you know her. She's lovely. You definitely know her. No, I definitely don't know her. Anyway, I reached out to her on LinkedIn. I said, hi, Liz. Want to have a Zoom call? I'm just interested to know, what did you do after your PhD? So I Zoomed her and she told me, I'm working as a lecturer in nursing in RCSI Bahrain. I said, I didn't know RCSI had a university in Bahrain. She said, yeah, it's lovely. You should be open to it. It's a lovely place. I was like, yeah, maybe I will actually. That's not a bad idea. My sister worked in Dubai for 10 years, so I was kind of open to a sunny destination. And,
that's one way of describing it.
Yeah, so then basically, again, serendipity. So that was maybe in the March of the year. And then I was submitting my PhD in the December. In like October, November, she messaged me, hi, Maeve. I'm moving to Belgium. Any chance you want to apply for my job? I was like, okay. So I did, and I got it. And I started in January 2019 as a lecturer in nursing in RCSI Bahrain. And they were interested in midwifery at that time. They were saying to me, like, we really want your expertise as a midwife. And they put me leading the maternity nursing module. So I was teaching fundamentals of nursing and research, and I was teaching on the master's in nursing as well there. And part of the master's in nursing was in Abu Dhabi in Cleveland Clinic. So I actually did come here to Abu Dhabi while I was working in Bahrain with Professor Maura Pidgeon. She brought me with her lecturing a few times. And so I had a fantastic time. I absolutely loved Bahrain. It was just fab. Everything about it, I just loved it. Except that it wasn't midwifery.
Yep.
So basically, I wanted to really keep up my midwifery. And I was kind of keeping a thing, you know, a feeler out the whole time for what's going on in midwifery world. And again, serendipity, I was put in contact with Billy Hunter, who was looking for midwifery lecturer in Cardiff. And I was like, oh my God, this is an amazing opportunity. Yes, 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 I will apply for midwifery in Cardiff with this fantastic midwifery team. And so I applied to Cardiff, and again, it was just during the pandemic. So my interview was in February 2020, and the pandemic kicked off in March 2020. So it was all a bit of a crazy year. We're going online, like it was just very, very stressful. It was very, very stressful. So I came home from Bahrain in the June, and I started in Cardiff in the August 2020. Yeah. So I joined that team, and it was just an amazing experience. It was so fantastic. They were a lovely midwifery education team. And I learned so much from them. I was involved in so many different things as senior lecturer there. But everything was online, and it was very challenging to be in a new country where I knew nobody and I was far from my family. And actually, it was very difficult at the time to travel or anything because of various lockdowns. We were in and out of lockdowns, and the team were so supportive of me. Grace Thomas and Lucy Warren, all of the team, they really supported me to work at home when I could. And so I did stay in Cork for a couple of weeks. Sorry, I got locked down in Cork. I got locked down there. What am I saying? I actually did. We were in and out of lockdown. So I was locked down with my mother and father for a couple of weeks. In the January, it was just so interesting. I think I was talking to you in the beginning there about some of the admissions processes and the quality of students that we had in Cardiff. They were just so passionate and really keen and willing to be midwives, and some of them had some fantastic experience already, you know, maybe they were breastfeeding counsellors, or they were already, you know, like in that midwifery field as doulas. So many like really passionate driven women who were like, I know they're going to be fantastic midwives already. Even from the interview, when you meet them, you're like, yes, these are gold. So it was a fantastic, fantastic experience. My partner Paul is here in the Middle East, so I was doing long distance relationship and everything like that, trying to juggle my own life. And basically, by sort of the following summer, I was kind of thinking, well, how is this going to work? There was no travel. No one was traveling anywhere, and everything was in lockdown. It was just very, very challenging. So I was kind of thinking, okay, well, I'm open to various different options, but at the moment, Cardiff is difficult to travel in and out of.
Yeah.
So we decided to come here. Well, the opportunity came up in Fatima College, and it is basically the first bachelor's midwifery program is being developed here in Abu Dhabi. And I was so thrilled to find out who my colleague was going to be. It was Dr. Georgina Sosa, who is just incredible. So I came out here in October last year, 2021. I joined Gina, and we have been working so hard writing this new midwifery curriculum. And we've got all our fingers and toes crossed. We're going for accreditation in the next week. We're like at the very end. We're like ready for our holidays now after working so hard at this curriculum. But it's going to be so exciting if we do manage to start this, because it will be starting from August 2022. We'll have 30 undergraduate midwifery students direct entry, which will be just so amazing. So Abu Dhabi, to give you some background, I don't know if you know that much about it.
Nope.
But it is one of the Emirates in the United Arab Emirates. It's about an hour from Dubai.
Mm-hmm.
So Fatima College is a college of health sciences, which has students for nursing, paramedics, radiography, pharmacy, physiotherapy, and soon to have midwifery.
Interesting combination.
Yeah, so health sciences. And it is led by Sheikh Fatima, who is the mother of the nation. So her drive is to really support Emirati women to get jobs and professions, and she's really supported them to get degrees, which is really, really fantastic. So we have graduate nurses already, and I'm working already lecturing those nurses over the last 6 months, and it's been brilliant to meet those students. They're just so passionate about what they're doing, and they're just really dynamic. I was saying to you about lecturing them online earlier, and even in the online, they're really, really enthusiastic and dynamic students. So it's really, really interesting to meet them. So at the moment, we are trying to scope out midwifery in Abu Dhabi, and what does that look like? Do they have midwives here? Where are they working? How do they work? Where do they work? And what exactly is that looking and feeling like? And at the moment, we're doing educational audits as well to see how will those midwives in practice support our bachelor's midwifery students to really get their full scope of practice. And particularly, we're interested in, will they get the skills and the normal physiological processes? Which is challenging, because so far, as we can see, a lot of midwives are not working in their full scope of practice because of the shortages of midwives. Mostly midwives are working in the labour ward at present. We've met some really inspiring midwives. We have a little sort of group where we've met up every now and then to just chat and feel inspired and speak midwifery and be amongst midwives, which is just lovely. And so we're trying to sort of spread the word that these students are going to be coming out. And actually, if we're successful, like, the number of midwives is actually going to double within maybe 4 or 5 years if it's successful, because we'll have 30 student midwives in the first cohort, and then we're hoping to increase to 50 in the second and maybe 50 in the third.
Wow.
All going well. And currently we've met probably about under 100 midwives so far. So I think that's going to have a significant impact on the midwifery sort of landscape here in Abu Dhabi.
Yeah.
There is a demand for the midwifery services. I think that women do want to have midwifery care, but could be challenges in terms of Emirati women themselves even understanding what is a midwife and the culture of actually not having a doctor as such, seeing you for every appointment. And things like continuous monitoring are very normalized here. And that might be challenging, trying to sort of navigate that and bringing that in. So we're hoping to help midwives to have antenatal clinics, have them working in all of the scope of practice, and not just focusing on the labor and birth where they're working at the moment, but they are doing fantastic things there as well. So the midwives that we have met are obviously working in a lot of leadership roles as well, because there are so few midwives. They tend to be like matrons in the field, or, you know, like in leadership roles, which is really, really brilliant. And that is an incentive to study midwifery as well, isn't it? Because you will be able for a specialist in a leadership role on graduation. So let's see. We've had our launch a couple of weeks ago. We had our launch on the 19th of April with our undergraduate student nurses. So just to explain the program to you, it's going to be a 4-year degree program. The first year is general requirements. So all the students in the health sciences college do first year, which is like anatomy, physiology, microbiology, you know, various science subjects, and just a grounding. They do different elective modules, and that will be their sort of foundation year. And then from there, they'll decide whether they want to do nursing or midwifery. And when they start into midwifery, so from August, they will be starting to second year midwifery. And that will be the year where they focus on their fundamentals of midwifery and their normal physiological. So they would have hopefully sort of midwifery led ethos and all of that normality coming through in second year, as we normally would have in the international standards. Then in third year, we would be doing the more complex. So women with complex needs, newborns with complex needs, and all of that sort of care, obstetric emergencies, etc., as per international standards. And then finally, in fourth year, they'll be doing things like leadership, research and innovation, and okay. consolidated clinical practice. So they will have four consolidated clinical practice placements. So all of our curriculum has been benchmarked with the International Confederation of Midwives standards, yep. and we've also aligned with the QF Emirates, which are the local standards, and we're using the BFIs as well for breastfeeding.
So are they going to come out with a Bachelor's of Midwifery or a Bachelor of Midwifery's Honours?
BSM, Bachelor of Science Midwifery.
So not with the honours attached.
And then we're also trialling the block placement of our block system of placements, which means that they will do like 8 weeks theory, 8 weeks placement, yep. or 15 weeks theory, 15 weeks placement, whatever, which would be similar to the UK, because at present here, what they do is 2 days placement, 1 day lab, 2 days theory. They kind of mix it up. Yep. So it's not, so we're going to trial it this way. And we're just really hopeful that they're going to love it and fall in love with midwifery.
That's exciting. It's knowing where they're going to end up. I think that'll be, once you know where they're going to end up and they've got that preceptor there, then being able to change the country within half a decade and double the amount of midwives in a country, that we know from other countries how much benefit that is to women. Changes rates, decreases maternity, mortality rates, but also increases satisfaction, increases all of those measures that we know that women kind of like take into their next births in a more positive way.
It's so exciting. We're so excited to be part of this and to have this opportunity. Like, honestly, to have had the opportunity to work at this level, and just to acknowledge as well all of the work that went into this before me and Gina even got here. Dr. Gleason and Dr. Annie obviously put in the original application for accreditation, and then we were employed on the back of their work. So just to acknowledge all the work that was done before we got here, because to get in at this stage is just so exciting. And hopefully by sort of mid next year, we might be able to employ more people on the team as well, and we'll need people with more assimilation skills. And it's like you said, it's a growing opportunity, and it's just like really, really, it's brilliant.
I forgot to ask you, how did you celebrate your PhD when you finished it? How did you celebrate?
Oh, well, I am queen of celebrations. And I'd say I had about five different celebrations.
Excellent.
So, the thing about the PhD is it's never ending, Liz. Okay, yep. So you celebrate when you submit the thesis.
Yes.
Then you celebrate when you get your viva.
Yep.
And then you celebrate when you do your corrections.
Yep.
And then you graduate. So how many is that? Is that four times?
That's four so far.
Yeah, that's four. So then you graduate. So I'm going to only count, I mean, I celebrate on all those things, varying from like pizza parties to, you know, drinks with friends. And then for the actual graduation, I was at home. It was actually February 2020, just before the pandemic, the 27th of February, and the pandemic was announced on the 1st of March.
Yep.
So I was in Ireland the 27th of February to graduate. I celebrated with my family. It was lovely. My nephews helped me celebrate, and my parents in the rain. And then I came back to Bahrain, and my team in Bahrain were just fantastic. They brought me a big cake and my students and everything. It was a big celebration actually with the team at RCSI Bahrain. They were fantastic. So we did celebrate a lot. It was fantastic.
Oh, it's hard work. Yeah. It's worthy of celebrating, and every milestone needs to be celebrated in one form or another, absolutely.
And the Cochrane review, when I submitted that, I got myself a pair of earrings. I was like, that has to be acknowledged.
So that does.
A little piece of jewellery.
That does again. So you've got, and thankfully now that you're actually in Dubai, you've got a better balance within your kind of like work and personal balance now, because you've at least kind of like close to and able to be with your partner.
Yeah. So exactly. It's just much, much easier at the moment. And obviously the weather is so much better. It's really nice out here. Bright. I've settled in well. I haven't actually been home since October. So I am dying to go home because my little sister had a baby boy called Rian about, he's about 12 weeks now. And I haven't met him yet. And my older sister is expecting a baby in July. So when I get home, my family will have double the amount of nephews or nieces that I have. I don't know what the next one is going to be, but we've got three boys, so there'll be another one on the way. I've had two nephews for, 4 years, and suddenly in 1 year I'll have two more.
Hold them up.
Nieces and nephews. Yeah. So it's exciting. I'm really excited to go home now in July, actually. So that'll be good. And
I always nice talk things. With
my midwife friends as well then when I go home and everything like that. So
with the world opening up now, it's just kind of it's getting small. Even though it was very small with technology over the last few years, and people could communicate a lot more and go attend a lot more conferences because you didn't have any air miles and costings. But now it's that kind of that physical face to face that I think we're all needing, that oxytocin kind of like hug.
Yeah.
Kind of like
traveling was difficult, and I didn't tell you I had COVID myself in January, and I've been quite sick this year since I've got to Abu Dhabi. Yes, life has been easier, but actually I've been very sick. So that's why I didn't travel in March as well, to just give myself that time to recover. So looking forward to going back now in July, and hopefully we'll know by then whether we've got the accreditation or not, and then to come back and start 15th of August with our new class of midwives.
That'll just be so exciting. You'll be buzzing to kind of like start teaching, and so will the students. Yeah. The atmosphere would just be quite electric.
Yeah, I think so. So we have a simulation day next week to sort of entice more students to apply as well. We're kind of doing birth simulations, and some of these new models are just so incredible, aren't they? Like, you can set them up to have all sorts of scenarios, so it's going to be quite funny, I think, to see the different simulations. And we're going to involve the paramedics as well, so we'll have interdisciplinary approach to it, which will be lovely.
Well, thank you so much for your time tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. You'll find all the links on Twitter, Instagram, and on the podcast website. If you are a midwife and you would like to share your research, your postgraduate studies, or even the quality improvement projects you are doing now, then email me at throughthepinard@gmail.com. Send me a tweet or send me a DM.